night screens and a scattered plot glow. We cast a net where the...
Welcome to Base by Base, the paper cast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. Imagine you're hunting for a genetic mutation that causes a rare heart disease. If you test 100,000 people in a single city, you might actually find it.
Right, because of the local concentration.
Exactly. But if you test 100,000 people spread uniformly across an entire country, you might completely miss it.
Which sounds completely backwards, I know.
It really does. But why does that happen? Because when it comes to human DNA, you know, casting a wider net actually changes the reality of what you catch. We are living through an absolute explosion in the scale of human genetic data right now.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, human biobanks, these massive repositories of genomic information, they're just growing exponentially. We're looking at data sets now reaching hundreds of thousands of individuals.
Right. But as we build these massive databases, we're also dramatically expanding where we sample these individuals from. We're shifting from like localized city-scale samples to national or even global scales.
Yeah, which brings up the core issue.
Right, so what really happens when we cast a wider geographic net for human DNA? Does it actually change the genetic variants we discover?
It absolutely alters the genetic landscape we uncover. When you change the geographic breadth of a study, you know, the physical area you're drawing your subjects from, you fundamentally alter both the frequency and the sheer number of the genetic variants you discover.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a profound shift in perspective that essentially dictates what we can and cannot see.
Which means this simple question of geography could completely change our hunt for disease-causing genetic mutations.
It really could. And today, we celebrate the work of Margaret C. Steiner, Daniel P. Rice, John November, and their colleagues across the University of Chicago, MIT, SecureBio, Johns Hopkins, and the Icahn School of Medicine, who have advanced our understanding of study design and the sampling of deleterious rare variants in biobank-scale datasets.
That is an absolute powerhouse of a research team.
It really is. And their work was published in the journal PNAS in June of 2025.
Okay, let's unpack this. Before we dive into the dense math and the biobank banks of today, we should probably, you know, set the stage for why this specific problem matters so much to researchers right now.
Yeah, setting the historical context is crucial here.
And where this whole line of questioning actually started, because in human genetics, researchers are practically desperate to find rare large effect variants, right?
Exactly. We're talking about the specific mutations that actually cause complex diseases or significantly increase your susceptibility to them.
Right.
Finding those mutations is basically the holy grail of precision medicine. But from an evolutionary standpoint, the universe is actively working against us finding them.
Because of natural selection.
Yes, natural selection fiercely weeds out those kinds of harmful mutations through a process called negative selection.
Right, okay.
Because these mutations are deleterious, meaning they are harmful to the organism's ability to survive and reproduce. Evolution continuously pushes them down to very, very low frequencies in the population.
So they don't disappear entirely then?
No, they don't disappear entirely simply because new mutations are always randomly springing up. But they do remain incredibly rare.
I'm trying to connect the dots here, though, because looking at the sources, this spatial puzzle, like how rare variants are physically scattered across a landscape, it isn't any question at all.
No, not at all. It goes back decades.
Right. We've got pioneering geneticists like Sewell Wright and Theodosius Dobzhansky in the 1940s, and later Bruce Wallace in the 1960s, studying this exact spatial phenomenon. But they weren't looking at human biobanks.
No, they were not.
I mean, they were chasing fruit flies.
Yeah, the classic Drosophila studies.
Exactly. Wallace actually figured out that the rate at which you'd find distinct lethal mutations in Drosophila decayed exponentially based on the geographic distance between the fly populations he sampled.
They did, yeah.
So how does hunting for lethal traits in 1940s fruit flies conceptually map onto modern biobanks looking for complex human disease traits? Just feels like two completely different worlds.
I get that, but the jump from fruit flies to human biobanks makes perfect sense when you realize that the underlying spatial mathematics of inheritance, mutation, and geography, they remain exactly the same.
Wait, really? The math is identical?
Essentially, yes. Those early researchers were trying to understand how a lethal mutation physically moves through a natural environment over time. They were, you know, literally walking between different fruit fly habitats, measuring distance.
Okay.
Today, we face the exact same spatial sampling questions. The only difference is that instead of walking through fields with a net, we're querying massive computational databases of human DNA.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, we are looking for the human equivalents of those fruit fly mutations, rare variants that cause disease. And we desperately need to know if the geographic way we collected our human samples is distorting our view of how common those diseases actually are.
Okay, so we know from the fruit flies that geography hides these mutations. But you can't just walk across the UK with a butterfly net collecting human DNA.
No, definitely not.
How on earth did they model that mathematically to bridge the gap to modern humans?
Well, the research team used a highly rigorous, three-pronged methodological approach to solve this. The first prong was building a purely theoretical mathematical model.
Okay, lay it on me.
They formulated what is called a stochastic branching process in continuous space.
A stochastic branching process sounds like a tool a Wall Street hedge fund uses to predict the stock market.
Well, actually, it's very similar in its use of probability. Think of it as a way to calculate the odds of a family tree spreading across a map over thousands of years.
Okay, I can picture that.
It's a mathematical environment that simultaneously accounts for three things. First, a new mutation randomly appearing. That's the stochastic part.
Right.
Second, the negative selection constantly pruning that family tree. And third, how that mutation physically diffuses or spreads over a two-dimensional geographic area generation by generation.
And the crucial parameter they introduced in this math model is something they call W, right? Which measures the sampling breadth.
Exactly, parameter W.
To help you visualize this, imagine you're looking at a map of a country in a dark room. The sampling breadth, WI, is like a spotlight you drop onto that map.
I love that analogy.
A very narrow sample. So a small lebu is like a concentrated 50-kilometer laser beam focused on a single city. You are only seeing the genetic variants illuminated within that tiny, intense beam.
Right.
But a broad sample is like swapping the laser beam for a uniform, diffuse floodlight that washes over the entire country.
That is a brilliant way to picture it. And to prove that their math regarding the laser beam and the floodlight actually worked in reality, they moved to the second prong of their methodology.
Which was?
Computer simulations. They used a sophisticated software program called SLIM to run individual-based forward-time genetic simulations.
Wait, let's remind the listener, because this is a crucial detail in the paper. They didn't just simulate abstract strings of code. They simulated deployed genomes.
Yes, very important distinction.
When you say diploid, we're talking about the fact that we inherit two sets of chromosomes, one from each parent, right? How does that complicate the simulation compared to simpler models?
It makes it exponentially more complex and much closer to human reality. Simple models often assume every variant is just a rare, independent data point.
Which isn't how biology works.
Not at all. By simulating diploid genomes, the researchers force the computer to track how two sets of chromosomes interact, recombine, and get passed down through multiple life stages of an organism, all while moving across a geographic grid.
Wow, that's intense.
Yeah, it was a rigorous stress test of their theoretical math, basically proving it holds up even when you introduce the messy realities of sexual reproduction and chromosomal inheritance.
But they didn't just leave it in the computer. They took it to the real world for the third prong.
They did. They turned to empirical, real-world data from the UK Biobank. Specifically, they performed in silico resampling.
And that basically means they computationally created artificial study cohorts using real human exome data, right?
Exactly. They focused heavily on the protein-coding regions of the genome, specifically chromosome 1.
And because the UK Biobank actually includes the birthplace coordinates for its participants, the researchers could literally simulate our spotlight metaphor.
They could. It's perfectly set up for that.
I love this part. They could look at a 50-kilometer radius, which, by the way, getting a 50-kilometer genetic sample in the middle of dense, diverse London is going to look a lot different than a 50-kilometer radius in the rural Scottish Highlands.
Well, undoubtedly.
But they compared that narrow 50-kilometer sample against a 100-kilometer sample, 150-kilometer sample, and finally uniform sampling across the entirety of Britain.
And that transition scaling up from 50 kilometers to the whole country is exactly what revealed the core phenomenon of the paper.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Like, what actually happens when you switch between the narrow laser beam and the wide floodlight?
Well,
the researchers unveiled a massive, fundamental trade-off that they call discovery versus dilution.
Yes, the discovery versus dilution trade-off. This dictates everything about what a genetic study will find. Let's start with the floodlight, the uniform sample.
Okay.
If you use broad uniform sampling across the whole country, you trigger the discovery effect. You end up discovering a much greater total number of distinct genetic variants.
Which, on the surface, sounds fantastic. I mean, yeah. More variants mean more potential discoveries for medicine, right?
It does sound fantastic until you encounter the dilution effect. Because you're casting such a wide net, you are capturing thousands of different localized family histories across a massive area.
Oh, I see.
So those distinct variants you just discovered are heavily diluted. Most of the new variants you find will appear as singletons.
Singletons?
Yeah, meaning out of your massive sample of hundreds of thousands of people, you only see that specific mutation in exactly one person.
Oh, wow. So when we switch to the floodlight, we're eliminating way more of the map, but the light hitting any specific mutation is so dim, so diluted, that it barely registers as a singleton. What if we swap back to the narrow laser beam?
When you use the narrow laser beam, you find fewer unique variants overall. The total count of distinct mutations drops significantly. However, the variants you do find are highly concentrated.
Because of local ancestry.
Right. Because you're sampling people who live physically close together and therefore likely share more recent geographic ancestors, the variants you discover are present at much higher frequencies in your sample.
Got it.
You see them in dozens or hundreds of people, not just as isolated singletons.
Let me pause you, because this paper tripped me up hard here. This leads to a crucial mathematical paradox.
Yes, it does.
The researchers state that despite these massive shifts in what you discover, you know, lots of singletons with the floodlight, higher frequencies with the laser beam, the expected average allele frequency across the whole study remains exactly the same.
It is deeply counterintuitive.
Yeah. The total expected heterozygosity doesn't change regardless of your sampling breadth. Let's define heterozygosity real quick for the listener. It's basically a measure of genetic variation, the probability that two alleles chosen at random from the population are different.
That's a perfect definition.
So how is it logically possible to find completely different counts of mutations depending on your spotlight, yet have the overall average genetic variation level remain totally unchanged?
The best way to understand the paradox is to look at the hard data from their UK Biobank experiment. When they moved from the narrow 50-kilometer sample to the broad uniform sampling across Britain, they found 72.3% more loss-of-function variants.
Wait, loss-of-function variants?
Yeah, these are the highly deleterious mutations, the broken genes that often cause severe disease.
Finding 72% more broken genes is a staggering increase in raw discovery.
It is massive. But remember the dilution effect. While they found 72% more distinct broken genes, the expected heterozygosity, meaning the frequency at which those specific variant sites appeared in the sample, dropped by 36.75%.
Let me try to summarize this to make sure I'm wrapping my head around the math.
Right.
If I'm a researcher and I switch to the floodlight, I am basically adding thousands of new columns to my massive spreadsheet. One for each new broken gene I discovered.
Yes, your spreadsheet gets much, much wider.
But because almost all of those new genes are singletons, I'm just filling those new columns with thousands of zeros and a single one.
Exactly.
So while the absolute number of distinct mutations grows wildly, the frequencies of each individual mutation plummet perfectly in tandem. The discovery of new, incredibly rare variants mathematically perfectly cancels out the dilution of the variant frequencies.
You nailed it.
So if I average the frequency across every single column on my spreadsheet, that average stays identically constant.
Yes. The math fundamentally balances out perfectly. The influx of ultra-rare singletons drag the individual site frequencies down at the exact same rate that the total number of sites goes up.
That is wild. But if the overall average stays the same in the spreadsheet, does this spatial scaling actually change how we do science in the real world? Like, does this change how we actually go about curing diseases?
It changes study design completely, and it impacts two major scientific fields in profound ways. Let's look at clinical research first, specifically genome-wide association studies, or GWIs.
Right, GWIs. These are the foundation of modern genetic medicine.
These are the studies where we scan the genomes of thousands of people to find the specific mutations statistically linked to a disease.
Exactly. Based on the discovery versus dilution trade-off we just unpacked, if you build a broad, geographically uniform biobank, you will discover far more potential disease targets. You hand researchers a huge list of distinct broken genes.
But because of the dilution effect, those targets appear at much lower frequencies. Most of them are singletons.
And that is a massive hurdle. In a single variant GWAS test, your statistical power to prove a connection is deeply tied to how frequently an allele appears in your sample. Right, you need a large sample size of the actual mutation.
Yes. If a mutation only shows up in one or two people out of 100,000, it's statistically incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to definitively prove that that specific mutation caused their disease. You simply lack the statistical power.
So the broad sample gives you a massive map of targets, but strips away your power to investigate them individually. You're trading concentration for discovery.
That is the clinical dilemma. Now, if we connect this to the bigger picture, the second major impact is on evolutionary genetics.
Okay, how so?
Evolutionary geneticists are trying to calculate the true strength of negative natural selection. They want to know how fiercely evolution is weeding out bad mutations.
And how does sampling breadth mess up our understanding of evolution?
It happens when researchers make a faulty assumption about their data. Imagine a researcher takes a narrow 50-kilometer sample, just the laser beam on one city.
Right.
But when they sit down to do the math, they analyze that data as if it represents a random panemictic population.
Let's define panemictic for the listener. That means assuming the population is perfectly and randomly mixed, right? Like a giant blender where anyone is equally likely to mate with anyone else in the country.
Yes, precisely. They treat their single city as a perfect microcosm of the entire global pool. But we know from the narrow laser beam effect that geographically narrow samples artificially concentrate rare variants.
Yeah, because of shared local ancestry.
Exactly. They appear at much higher frequencies in that single city than they do globally. If you feed those artificially high concentrated frequencies into your evolutionary models, your math will tell you that these deleterious mutations are much more common worldwide than they actually are.
Ah, I see it now. And if you think harmful mutations are common, you'll fundamentally underestimate how strongly natural selection is fighting to remove them.
Right.
Because if they were really that common, you would imply natural selection is doing a terrible job.
What's fascinating here is that simply ignoring the geographic breadth of your study can lead you to underestimate the strength of negative natural selection entirely. You end up with a skewed understanding of the human mutational load purely because you treated a narrow geographic sample as if it were a well-mixed global pool.
It's incredible how a simple geographic assumption can, ripple out and distort our entire view of human evolution.
It really is.
But we do have to acknowledge the limitations of the math here, right?
Yeah.
Because the paper points out that this beautiful theoretical model operates on a perfect, infinite, two-dimensional torus.
Yes, the torus. Mathematically speaking, a torus is essentially a donut shape.
A donut, okay.
What that means for the simulation is that the model has no boundaries. If a simulated human family line migrates off the top edge of the map, they just wrap around to the bottom like Pac-Man.
Right. There are no coastlines or mountains to stop them.
Exactly.
But the real world is infinitely messier than a donut. Britain, where they pulled the empirical data, is an island. It has hard coastlines.
Mm-hmm.
Humans have distinct geographic borders. We have complex histories of rapid population growth, and we have long-range migrations.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, you can hop on a plane in London and be in Tokyo tomorrow.
The abstract model certainly does not fully capture those massive leaps in migration or the complexities of modern borders. In reality, a geographically narrow 50-kilometer sample in a hyper-connected modern city like London might contain genetics from all over the globe, effectively acting like a broad sample in disguise.
Right, that makes sense.
But even with those real-world complexities, the empirical data from the UK Biobank proves that the fundamental mechanics of discovery and dilution still hold true. The math scales even if the maps are messy.
Well, geographic breadth isn't just an administrative detail then. It is a fundamental knob in genetic study design.
It absolutely is.
Turning that knob wider reveals more unique genetic variants, but it mercilessly dilutes their frequency. As a researcher, you're forced to navigate a strict, unavoidable trade-off between discovery and concentration.
It's a delicate balancing act. You cannot cheat the math of spatial distribution, no matter how large your database grows.
So, as we pack up our spotlight and look toward the future, I want to leave you with this to chew on. What does this mean for the design of the next generation of million-person biobanks, and how we balance the need for global genetic diversity with the statistical power to actually cure disease?
That is the big question.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use a donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
Screens and a scattered plot glow. We cast a net where the cold data flows, hunting the changes that hide in the few rare little echoes in somebody's blue. Go wider than habit, past comfort and town. More mutations rise up as the borders come down, but each one gets thinner. A whisper in hands when the same small story is spread through more lands. Wider map, quieter signal, still I believe. We find more names in the DNA sleeve. Count goes up, the frequency falls. Truth in the drift in the hospital halls. Design it right, let the sampling sing. So power and bias don't rule everything. Selection's a pressure you can't really see. It bends the rare variance, sets what can be. Sample size matters, but breadth has a say. Shaping the spectrum of what shows up today. Simulated worlds and resampling agree. Discovery blooms, but it won't come for free. In branching shadows and measure and sham, lineages flicker, then vanish mid-dance. W over C, how far we roam, decides what's common, decides what's alone. So if you want meaning, don't just chase the peak. Listen for patterns in the quietly weep. Wider map, quieter signal.